You're listening to an RNIB Connect Radio podcast.
Time now to talk guide dog blogs once again here on RNIB Connect Radio. Now, we have had Abby from Guide Dogs New South Wales from Australia on to talk about her dog Duke today. I got Abby back, but this time to try and look at some comparisons when it comes to guide dog ownership in the UK versus in Australia. Abby, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me once again.
How does a training process work in Australia with a new guide dog?
I actually opted to do my training from home because I had a few work things going on as well that I needed to do. So I did my 4 weeks of training at home. And then I think we decided to tack on another week or another kind of half week on the end of that. And then, yes, we also did an assessment walk as we did each route. Actually, we first worked on an exercise route, which was really good because that was something I wanted to do. But I just sort of moved to a new house 6 months before I got Duke, and I wasn't quite confident with the area and doing the exercise walk independently. So that was really nice to be able to do that. We also looked at doing a route to the local shopping centre, but it was a bit too much for Duke. He was getting a bit stressed. So we kind of canned that and we visited that a few months later.
Did you get visited once you've qualified with your guide dog? Did you get visited by your instructor kind of first more frequently to see how you're doing, and then the frequency kind of decreased to kind of annual visits?
Yes. So I believe the first follow-up was about a month. And then 3 months, and then 6 months, and then a year, and then annually after that. But we often do the follow-ups over the phone. And if you don't have any concerns, I guess that's kind of that. If the client and the dog are happy, the trainer's happy from what they've heard, they sometimes just keep it as a teleconsult.
What sort of challenges, and I'm talking challenges from all sorts of angles here, can guide dog owners face in Australia?
Pretty similar to what I heard at the IGDF conference with taxi refusals, restaurant refusals. Sometimes clients will try to check into a hotel and then they refuse or they're asked to pay for a cleaning fee, which is actually illegal for hotels to charge for that. So there are still difficulties with access here. Sometimes, you know, you get the odd person. I'm sure this is the same in the UK where they want to pat your dog. And you kind of have to explain. Sometimes English can be a barrier with some people. They genuinely don't understand what you're saying. But there are people that, you know, perfectly understand, but they're just not listening to what you're saying. I had a gentleman that was trying to pat Duke as we were getting on a train, and I was a little bit flustered because, you know, it was early morning. We were on the way to work that day. And he said, you know, what's the harm? I'm just giving him a pat. The harm is that, you know, he can fall between this platform and the train and you'll be responsible for him becoming injured. I have come across a few people that have been scared of him. He's a really big dog and he has a big head and like he has jowls. So I think some people, you know, maybe people that haven't had a pet dog before sometimes freak out when they see him. And they kind of shout out or they're like, oh, I'm scared. I'm like, well, that's okay. Just move to a different part of the train or a different part of the shop or whatever it may be. I once had a shopkeeper that told me that, and she, you know, she's like, can you keep your distance? And I was like, well, I'm your customer, but sure, I'll stay behind your counter. I'm not going to come around to the back of the counter because a customer wouldn't do that. So sometimes there was a few odd interactions, but the majority of people just adore seeing Duke.
When it comes to legal rights regarding, you know, hotels, public transport and taxis and legal rights in general going into venues, are they fairly the same to what they are in the UK, do you think, from what you've heard?
Yes, definitely. They seem to be exactly the same, you know, whether it's taxis or rideshare, they're not allowed to refuse. I'm not sure what the process is for kind of litigation in the UK. I think from the conference they might have said that there's, you know, there's a whole complaints process and you kind of have to go through the courts. Is that right?
Yes, I'm certainly going through similar cases, and often it kind of is a long process, but one that, you know, has to be done in order to kind of showcase that, you know, guide dog owners have got legal rights with their dog.
There is a government commission. I'm not sure if this is, you know, my state, New South Wales only, but what they're trying to do is They're trying to make the process a little bit easier for the guide dog handler. So they've actually increased the fine from $300 to about $1,000. And it's now an on-the-spot fine. So if one of their, taxi commissioners has seen a refusal at the airport, for example, they can give that driver an on-the-spot fine. Or there is a number that a guide dog handler or a member of the public that can put a they can put a complaint to, and then the fine can be issued as well directly to the driver. So they're just trying to make that process a little bit easier for handlers and less lengthy as well.
You've been on public transport both in the UK and Australia. Based on what you've seen, how it works, are there any significant differences with guide dogs on public transport?
I felt like on the tube, for example, it's quite narrow when you sit, and the seats, there's kind of two rows of seats facing each other. My understanding is that if there was someone with a pram sitting at the seat and someone with a guide dog and they were kind of sitting opposite, I don't believe you'd be able to fit the two together, or even maybe two guide dogs trying to sit opposite each other, or someone with luggage and someone with a guide dog. I wasn't sure if that would quite fit. We have two kind of main types of trains. We have our regular trains, and those kind of have a split level system. So in each carriage, well, there's like three levels. So you have an accessibility section. So that's just as you enter the train, so that you have one carriage on either side of the carriage. There are two doors on both ends, and that kind of enter the space where you enter is kind of a flat section. There are seats facing each other, like two rows of seats facing each other, but there's quite a big gap in between, and people can't even stand, even if there's a pram and a guide dog or luggage or a bike. There's still ample room. And then there's a kind of like an upstairs and downstairs part that you can go to. Then we also have the metro that's kind of similar to your tube, but I felt like our metros are slightly wider. So I have had Duke being able to comfortably sit opposite a pram.
How do guide dogs work in, hot weather, for example? Because, we know the heat in Australia can be quite considerate. What's the general rule when it comes to guide dogs working in the heat?
That's right. Yeah, it can get really hot here. Like, there's some summer days where it goes up to 40. On average, temperatures hover around 30 from anywhere between late November to the end of February, so it can be really warm for our guide dogs. We're always advised, if it gets hot, I like to have, 28, 29, 30 as a threshold. We're actually given little boots that they wear in the heat, because the pavement gets really hot. And actually, even worse than the pavement, it's the roads. When they're crossing the roads, that can really blister their feet. So we put the boots on them, if we know that they're going to be walking out, far. Especially in the middle of the day, I found that near my current office, he doesn't really need his boots if we're going close by, because the pavement doesn't heat up as much as other places in Sydney. For example, in the west, if I take him out west, it gets really hot, and he needs to wear his boots, anywhere from after 10 a.m. Until maybe the afternoon, like 5 p.m. If it gets too hot, we're advised not to take them out. I haven't been told what that threshold is. It would only be essential travel if it's over 30 degrees generally.
See, I like how you mentioned the dog boots because whenever I mentioned this, I was told that dogs sweat through their paws, so therefore putting the boots on them will cause issues with that. Was this covered at some point or mentioned at any stage when the boots were mentioned?
I think it was mentioned in the sense that Duke licks his, he tries to lick his paws when the boots are on. And I think the instructor did mention that, there's the extra sweating, and it can be uncomfortable and hot for them as well. But compared to, having their feet blistered, it's a really good protection against that. And they don't have to keep them on the whole day. So when I get to the office, I can take his boots off, and then he goes about licking his paws.
That's very interesting and certainly gives you a bit of an outlook on these things. Thank you very much, Abby, for joining us once again on Guide Dog Blogs from Australia here on RNIB Connect Radio.
For more interviews, features, and shows, go to your favorite podcast provider and search for RNIB Connect Radio.